We stopped this morning, chapter 7. We should be able to finish tonight the life and times of Gideon at the end of chapter 8 and verse 32. And we stopped this morning with the call of Gideon, and he has put forth the fleece, and he is convinced that it is really true that God has called him to go into battle for Israel, and we have put these under various headings. First, in verse 1, the nation now gathers. Chapter 7 and verse 1. Then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and camped beside the spring of Herod. And the camp of Midian was on the north side of them by the hill of Moreh in the valley. So you have the enormous encampment of the Amalekites, Midianites, and sons of the east, who have poured in across the Jordan River and are now in the land. They've poured in from the desert on the east into the land of Canaan. And now we're ready to do battle. Gideon has called forth warriors from four tribes. Go back to 635. He sent messengers throughout Manasseh. They were called together to follow him. He sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they came up to meet them. So you have four of the tribes, and you have a gathering of the nation ready to do battle, and you have a gathering of some 32,000 people that come from only four tribes. And as we noted this morning, one of the tribes is going to get offended because they did not get called to the battle, but nonetheless, you've got a good group, and you've got to say this is a noble group. It was voluntary, they didn't have to come into the battle, and therefore the 32,000 that have said, yes, we are willing and able to fight the Lord's battles, have gathered when we come down to chapter 7 and verse 1. However, this contains a problem. And the problem that is inherent right here is this. With 32,000 warriors, they could very well win the battle. And that's the problem. Because if the 32,000 win the battle on their own efforts and because of their own fighting, then the possibility is very real that they will think they won and they will forget that the battle is the Lord's. So we're going to start then in a reduction process. And so let's simply call the next part the few selected. And the reason for the selection is given in chapter 7 and verse 2. Why we need to do this? 7, 2 through 8 is the selection process. Notice verse 2. Let's just put this under first and second reduction. We've got to get rid of some of those 32,000, chapter 7 and verse 2, and the reason for it is because of the problem that is stated in verse 2. Reading. And the Lord said to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many for me to give Midian into their hands, lest Israel become boastful, saying, 'My own power has delivered me.'" In other words, God is simply saying, with that many people, the possibility of victory from the human standpoint is just entirely too great. And it would be very likely that, yes, they will win. But if they do win, they will not give me the glory because they will look at their numbers. Now, the inherent lesson, I think, in verse 2 is this. The victory, in verse 2, I take it assumes that if the 32,000 went into battle, they would win. However, there's a problem with that, and the problem is this. The victory would be meaningless unless the proper spiritual lesson was learned. And that's the problem. The victory would be meaningless. Granted, they will probably win. But that is not the issue. Victory is not the end issue. Victory would be meaningless unless the proper spiritual truth were learned. Namely, that the battle was given to us by the Lord. The victory would be meaningless unless the proper truth was learned. And God looks at the potential and he says, with this amount of people, with your state of preparedness, yes, you will probably get the victory. But if you get the victory and don't learn the lesson of the victory, the whole thing is going to mean nothing. Therefore, you begin with that problem and you begin the reduction of the people into a much, much smaller group. So that the number, and the principle will be this, the number has to be reduced from 32,000 to a number that is so small that nobody will deny this was a supernatural victory. In other words, that's going to be the aim of the reduction, to get down to 300 people. And with 300 people against the hordes of Amalekites and sons of the east and the Midianites, the only thing that will ever give them victory is going to be supernatural. And God says, that's where you've got to get. Okay, that's the problem. For that then, they introduce a test. How are we going to reduce down to a lower number? And the test is proposed in 7:3. Now therefore come, proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, whoever is afraid and trembling, let him return and depart from Mount Gilead. So 22,000 remained, but 22,000 people returned, but 10,000 remained. So you have a loss of 2/3. So the idea is 1 in 3 was ready for the battle, is the proportion, or ready to fight. And thus, you have the reduction of the troops, and then you have again a second step down or second reduction. First reduction, verses 2 and 3. And now notice the second reduction comes on here. By the way, there's an interesting parallel to the idea that's involved in this, and I ran across it reading Tacitus. In his annals, he makes this remark. He said, even with many legions, it is always the few who win the battle. And the emphasis is that it's not the number, but the courage and the skill of the few that wins the battle. So, we're down now to 10,000, and we have to reduce that again. So we're down from 32 on the first reduction. We're down now to 10,000 people. The problem with that is 10,000 people could probably win the victory. And if the 10,000 could probably win the victory, they would gain the victory, but Israel would not learn the proper truth, and therefore more important than the victory is the truth that is learned from it and the glory that is given to God. So we go then into our second reduction. The first has been reduced by who is afraid. And now for the second reduction, we have verses 4 through 8. Notice beginning at verse 4, the emphasis is on divine selection. Up until now, it's been pretty subjective. The troops were called out from the four tribes, and they responded as they chose to respond. Gideon asks how many are afraid and tremble, and some of them raise their hands and say, yes, we're scared to death, we would like to go home, and they're dismissed. But notice with this next reduction, the emphasis is on divine selection. And that is in verse 4. Verse 4 emphasizes divine selection and choice that was not emphasized in the other two. Reading verse 4 that makes that clear. Then the Lord said to Gideon, the people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Therefore it shall be that he of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, he shall go with you. But every one of whom I say to you, this one shall not go with you, he shall not go. And so notice the emphasis is God saying, I am going to tell you who my people are and who I desire to go into the battle. And the emphasis would be that God, who knows the qualities for battle, is able to select. He knows those that can make it and those that cannot. Notice also that the selection basis was based on the way they drank water. Selection was based on the manner of drinking water, and it would be obvious we've got to answer a question. Is how would the way a person drinks water indicate whether or not he's a warrior or not? How does a ready, equipped warrior in Israel drink water differently than one that is not? And that is going to be the criteria on which some are rejected and some are chosen. So notice we have, again, coming now down to verse 5. So he brought the people down to the water. And the Lord said to Gideon, you shall separate everyone who laps the water with his tongue, as a dog laps, as well as everyone who kneels to drink. And the choice then is based on those two things. And let's list what they are. First of all, some came to the water and lapped. Some knelt, or we ought to put most knelt. And we've got our figures on that. We know how many did which. The ones that lapped were 300. The ones that knelt were 9,700. 9,700 were disqualified. Now, what is the emphasis and what does this means of drinking indicate and tell us? Well, basically, look at verse 6, and let me give you a little more vivid translation, I think, of the way the Hebrew goes. Verse 6, literally translated, says this: now the number of those who licked the water with their hands to their mouths. Get that? Licked the water with their hands to their mouths, as over against those that knelt. So we're getting a little more focus on the posture. Basically, those that knelt, where would their face be? As they knelt beside the water, they would stick their face down to the water and they would drink from it. Those that did not kneel, instead lap from their hands, would be doing what? They would be reaching over, getting, and you've seen this done, getting a handful and lick from their hands, bringing their hands to their mouth to make a little cup or bowl out of it. Now, that was the basis then on which the ones who were equipped and fit for battle were chosen. Now, what would be the difference then? Why or what would make the kneeler and the lapper different? You stop and think, and this, again, to a certain extent, is conjecture. But I take it what he is simply saying is this: those who lapped stood upright where they could face the enemy. And thus, the lappers kept their eye open or kept alert for the enemy. Remember, they are close to the enemy lines now. The kneelers would be looking face down into the water, and thus they were somewhat indifferent to the enemy. In other words, the ones that knelt would be a little bit more vulnerable, and they would indicate that here we are very near the enemy lines. And being near the enemy lines means we need to be alert and awake. And we don't have time to lay down or kneel down or lie down flat on the ground and drink, because what if the moment we were prostrate over the water, the enemy would suddenly appear? We would be caught, as we would put it, flat-footed or flat-kneed down on the ground. As against the others that would be very much ready for battle, they're on their feet. The moment the enemy appears, they're standing up, they're ready to go. You do not fight well in a battle when kneeling, especially when using a sword. And I take it that's why the two postures are dealt with in this context. Now let's draw out of that, I think, an important principle. And we'll just make these just two observations so far on this passage. Number one, first of all, this passage teaches two of the major characteristics of genuine warriors. What are the characteristics of a genuine warrior in Israel? What is noteworthy about them that was not true of the other people? And we've had two characteristics so far in the passage. The first one is this: they never seek their strength in numbers. A genuine warrior for the Lord never seeks his strength in numbers. And very vividly, they could look at the 300 people and say, we used to be 32,000 people. But the 300 were not bothered that there used to be 32,000 and now there are only 3, because they were real warriors. And real warriors do not count noses. They do not seek their strength in numbers. But there's a second principle that is also true, and we find it in the first reduction, and that is this. They never weaken their ranks by receiving the fearful. They never seek strength in numbers. They never reduce or weaken their ranks by receiving the faint-hearted. They never weaken their ranks by receiving the faint-hearted. Or here, the fearful means faint-hearted. And when they lose two-thirds, it doesn't upset the 300. Because the 300 have this kind of orientation. Numbers doesn't count. And second, we do not want numbers that are weak. We would be better to do without two in every three than to have three people, two of which are fearful of the battle. And therefore, we've got the characteristics of a genuine warrior in Israel. Second, and this has to do with the second reduction. We know, and we've had the principle over and over when we went through 2 Corinthians, that the background for the display of God's power is human weakness. But notice, the background for the display of his power is not cowardice. So, a principle. God glorifies himself through the weak, but not through the coward. He eliminates the coward. God glorifies himself through the weak, not the cowardly. The cowardly get sent home, and they do not participate in the battle. And that's an important distinction to note there, is that while 300 are very weak, they weren't cowardly. Those are eliminated. So two important observations coming off of this context. Now, let's move to the battle fought. Battle fought, 9 through 25. Battle fought, 9 through 25. And first, we've got the preparation. To get into battle, and that is found, well, we didn't read in the narrative how we get down to the 300. Verse 6, the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people kneeled to drink the water. So we've now got the alert, the battle ready. And the Lord said to Gideon, verse 7, I will deliver you with the 300 men who lapped and will give the Midianites into your hands, so let all the other people go, each man to his own home. And now we have filtered out the fearful, we have reduced the ranks, and now we're ready for a battle to be fought. And you have the preparation, and the preparation involves several things. First, right mental attitude, verses 9, 10, and 11. Verse 9. Now the same night it came about that the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hands. But if you're afraid to go down, go with Purah, your servant, down to the camp. That would be his armor bearer, Gideon's armor bearer. And you will hear what they say. And the key to preparation for the battle is to get down there, and you're going to find out that there is panic in Midian. And I'm going to let you know about it ahead of time to prepare you for the battle. So verse 11, you will hear what they say, and afterward your hands will be strengthened. Notice the emphasis is on preparation, and you can't be prepared if your mental attitude is not right, and it isn't right now. So we need to get you all prepared by a right mental attitude. So verse 11, he went with Purah his servant down to the outpost of the army that was in the camp. So you have the attitude which is now right, and so this is the beginning of the battle. The second thing that he needs to emphasize is not only get encouraging words, but note the massive size of the army. And the massive size is emphasized in verse 12. Now the Midianites, the Amalekites, and the sons of the east were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts. Their camels were without number, as numerous as the sand on the seashore. So two things have happened, if you can, in your imagination. This, by the way, is just perhaps an hour or so before 10 o'clock at night. We have a time fix on this in the passage. So it's nighttime, it's dark in Palestine, and they have... God has said, I want you to take you and your armor bearer, go down there, and you're going to hear something, and you're going to come back, and you're going to say, we can win. And the reason you need to see that, Gideon, is so you can pass it on to your soldiers. So we're going to have two men going down. They're going to hear something. We don't know what it is yet, but they're going to hear something that is going to make them come home and say, we know the battle is ours. But just in order to impress them with the enormity of God's victory he's going to give them, he says, take a look at them. You can't even begin to count their weapons, their camels, their personnel. It's massive in size. Following that, we find out what Gideon heard, which is the dream of a Midianite soldier. So the dream of the soldier comes next in the context of verse 13. And again, you're over in the bushes, very quiet, being careful not to be heard. So verse 13, when Gideon came, behold, a man was relating a dream to his friend. And he said, behold, I had a dream. A loaf of barley was tumbling in the camp of Midian. And it came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat. Now, if you know anything about a barley cake, there's several things that describe it. In the first place, a barley cake was very small, of extremely low quality, and the only people who ate barley cakes were either the destitute or the extremely poor. And so, what is he saying? I don't know how to illustrate it. Perhaps in our terms, the soldier has a dream, and he is they're down at Kemper Arena. And as the Kemper Arena is in front of them, a piece of Melba toast fell on the roof of Kemper. Well, it probably would mash it. At any rate, falls on Kemper Arena. The whole thing collapses and turns over, which is ridiculous. You don't tear down a building with some... And that's exactly the emphasis here. Is a soldier said, the strangest thing happened to me in my dream is this little old, cheap, inexpensive barley cake that nobody but destitute people eats. It fell on the tent and it wiped us out. And as Gideon and his armor bearer hear that, you have the interpretation of that in verse 14. His friend answered and said, this is nothing less than the sword of Gideon, that this referring to the barley cake. This barley cake is nothing less than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given Midian and all the camp into his hand. And so with that, he is able to go back, encouraged that the victory is theirs, and God has made him prepared by getting his mental attitude right. Following the preparation, he comes back and gives the instructions. And the instructions come to us now in verses 15 and following. The first thing that was straightened out with Gideon before battle was his mental attitude. And when he comes back, the first thing he does with the soldiers is correct their mental attitude. So, first and foremost, right mental attitude. And keep in mind how critical that is. God says, Gideon, you're not ready. You need to get your attitude right, and I'm going to give you the truth so you'll have a right attitude. And he hears of the dream, and he says, I know we can win the battle. So, two out of 300 know that the battle is going to be the Lord's. The other 298, or the other, probably 299 of them, are not ready for battle either. So Gideon says, I want to start you the same place that God started me. Right mental attitude. And what do we have then in verse 15? It came about when Gideon heard the account of the dream and its interpretation that he bowed in worship. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise, for the Lord has given the camp of Midian into your hands. So 300 across the board began with the right mental attitude. The next step was to devise a battle plan. And the battle plan was designed in such a way that there were no weapons whatsoever. The absence of swords, the absence of chariots is obvious in the context. First of all, notice he takes in the battle plan, the first thing he does is to divide the 300 into three bands. If you read any ancient history, that was very, very common, to divide an army up into three bands. The reason for it was to give the enemy the appearance of they're coming from all sides. It was also so that you could have a three bands, and you could have the first band attack, and then the other two bands could come around from the sides, and thus you had a frontal attack, you had a right attack, and you had a left attack. So typical of those types of things, you divide the soldiers up into groups of 100 each. Okay, now coming down to verse 16, he then equips his men, distributes weapons, and it's laughable. He divided, this is verse 16, he divided the 300 men into three companies. And he put trumpets, the trumpet would be a ram's horn. A ram's horn and empty pitchers into the hands of all of them with torches inside the pitchers. Basically, the light or the torch would essentially be dipped in tar or many times dipped in rosin and lighted. And the technique was then to take the torch, put it down head first into the pitcher where it would simply smolder. Then when you pull it out, wave it, and it would burst into flame. So that is the plan then. You've got a rosin dipped torch stuck down into a cheap opaque pot and it's smoldering. And you've got, in the other hand, a trumpet or a ram's horn. And that is the equipment of Israel, 300, to go into battle and to win. Now, what's the difference in that and where we started out? 32,000 men with horses and chariots, perhaps, and 32,000 with swords could probably win. So could 10,000. But look at what we got now. We've got the massive Midianite encampment. You can't even count them for numbers. They're all over the place. They have swords. They have chariots. They're equipped and ready for battle. And here we go, guys, in three groups. I've got my little pot with a torch in it that's smoldering away. And thanks, Gideon, for this ram's horn. What am I going to do with it? Beat them to death? But one thing is going to become obvious. If they win, we know where the victory came from. And no victory is worth anything, even if we win, if we don't understand the doctrinal lesson that goes with it, or the theological lesson that goes with it, namely, the battle was won by the Lord. And that's going to be made very, very, very clear. Okay, now notice the victory coming down to verse 19. Preparation, instructions, and now the victory. And the victory is narrated in 19 through 23. First of all, from verse 19, we know what time it was. Because verse 19 says, so Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. The night was divided into watches of 4 hours apiece, starting at 6 o'clock. So the middle watch would be 10 p.m. at night. Not only was it 10 p.m. at night, but notice they had just posted the watch, which means the soldiers from the camp that had doubtless been around a campfire had gone out to the outposts. And you can imagine very well that it would take, I don't know how long at night it would take, but it would take them a good amount of time for their eyes to adjust to the darkness. And this is the perfect timing, because you come down to the victory part. And notice coming to verse 17. They have their torches and their pitchers, and he said, look at me and do likewise, and behold, when I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I and all, and what is happening now is the frontal approach is made by Gideon and the 100 men with him. The rest of them would have come around on the outside. So you've got three parts of the camp of the Midianites and the Amalekites and the sons of the east covered up. And Gideon says, when I give the signal, I want you to all do the same thing. So, verse 18, when I and all who are with me blow the trumpet, then you blow the trumpets all around the camp and say, for the Lord and for Gideon. So Gideon and 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. When they had just posted the watch, and they blew the trumpets, smashed the pitchers that were in their hands, with the three companies, blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers, held the torches in their left hands, and the trumpets in their right hands for blowing, and cried, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. And each stood in his place around the camp, and all the army ran, crying as they fled. Now you say, well, why in the world would they flee at that? Well, we need a little more background that will fill it in. Very often, in fact, almost always, at nighttime in ancient marches, a detachment of men was led by a torchbearer. And it's simply like he stands at the front of the line and waves his torch, and you know behind him there's got to be oodles of men. Now, you get the picture? All of a sudden, the torches of the 300 men on three sides begin to wave. And the Midianites would look and say, good grief. That's only the leader of the group. That's just the torchbearer. Let's get out of here and split. So they take off and flee, and the victory becomes obvious in the context. And notice verse 21, how each soldier of the 300 stood in his place. No sword, no weapon, no fleeing. He's just standing, though, just as though his detachment of men has just marched up, and suddenly the Midianites are surrounded and they take off in the fourth direction. Well, following that, you have a little mopping up to do. Verse 24. Gideon sent messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim, saying, come down against Midian and take the waters before them as far as Beth-barah and the Jordan. So all the men of Ephraim were summoned, and they took the waters as far as Beth-barah and the Jordan, and they captured the two leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, and they killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and they killed Zeb at the winepress of Zeb when they pursued Midian, and they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon from across the Jordan. So notice, called in to kind of help mop up is Ephraim. Well, that leads us to the next section, which we will call the complaint is now lodged. 8:1-3. Basically, in verse 1 and 2 and 3, you have two things. First, you have a picture of Ephraim's arrogance. And second, in verse 2 and 3, you've got an example of Gideon's prudence. First, the arrogance. Chapter 8, verse 1. The men of Ephraim said to him, what is this thing you have done to us, not calling us when you went to fight against Midian? And they contended with him vigorously. And the first thing to say about Ephraim's attitude is, note, this is exactly the kind of arrogance and pride that God will not tolerate. And thus, they could not qualify. Ephraim believed that the battle was to be won by human power. We needed to come along and help you. And thus God is saying, reduce the number. Ephraim says, you got to up the number. You need us. And we are hurt that we have been left out. Actually, the greater part of Gideon's army had been eliminated, remember, to demonstrate that the power was of God, not of them. So, basically, what's Ephraim objecting to? We object to the 300 men that went into battle. We should have been there also. So that Ephraim, I think, illustrates a proverb. Look at Proverbs 13:10. And the first line of the proverb will describe Ephraim. The second line describes Gideon. Proverbs 13:10. Proverbs 13 and verse 10. Through presumption, or if you have an older King James, you've got the word, I believe, contention. Through contention comes nothing but strife. That's Ephraim. But with those who receive counsel is wisdom. That is going to be Gideon. And so coming onto the picture, you have By the way, we might note another principle. Guess when cowards become valiant? Cowards inevitably become valiant when the victory is won. They become valiant upon victory. Now granted, Gideon didn't come to Ephraim and ask him to join the battle, but when they were going into battle, the 32,000, I didn't see any Ephraimites, did you? Where were they? They certainly knew about this. They could have volunteered service, but they exhibit the arrogance that was typical of them in this particular context. There's another principle I think involved here is great men like Gideon must expect to have their patience tried by the unkindness of the people they serve. Was it to Ephraim's advantage that Israel won the battle over Midian and the Amalekites? Absolutely. You would have thought that they would have been grateful. But right in the middle of the whole foray, Gideon has to stop and put up with the unkind actions of the Ephraimites that he's really acting on their behalf and he's really trying to serve them. And wouldn't you expect, when does this all happen? After the battle? No, right in the middle of it. Because notice down at chapter 8, verse 4, then Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came to Jordan and crossed over, weary and yet still pursuing. So they get yipped at by their own Israelites right in the middle of the battle. That is an eternal principle of service. Notice the weary yet pursuing. What does that remind you to? I'm going to a cross reference. Can you follow me if you've been going with us in our studies? Who's that sound like? Absolutely worn out, but still slugging away. Doesn't that take you to 2 Corinthians 11? 2 Corinthians 11. Keep in mind what's in the context. They have just done battle with the enemy. They are worn out, and yet they're being nipped at by their own people. Did that ever happen to Paul? Weary in the battle, and at the same time being nipped at by his own people? What's the context of 2 Corinthians? 2 Corinthians, you had the Corinthians who were listening to the apostate teachers. They were turning against Paul. In the midst of all of it, what happens? Well, you come down to something like chapter 10, verse 27. I have been in labor and hardship, through many sleepless nights, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. But what brings the suffering to its ultimate climax? Not the sufferings from the Jews, not the sufferings from the Gentiles or the Romans, but the sufferings that come from guess who? 28. Apart from such external things, this is just as though he's bringing it to a climax, there is the daily pressure upon me of concern for all the churches. So if we kind of paraphrase it, up through to verse 27, to make it like the instance with Gideon, up through verse 27 is all the things that the Midianites had done toward Israel. Israel then goes in to win the victory, and what you have in verse 28, the concern for the churches and problems from them, would represent what the Ephraimites, his very own people, were doing to Gideon. So back to that in chapter 8. Paul's ultimate pressures came not from the pagans, but from the Christians, unfortunately. So you've got then Ephraim's arrogance, and that is coupled now with Gideon's wisdom, or prudence. Chapter 8, verse 2. I like the way someone put it. Gideon knew how to conquer because he also knew how to bend. And he's going to bend in this verse. He knew how to conquer, he also knew how to pacify. So he does so, verse 2. But he said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God has given the leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, into your hands. And what was I able to do in comparison with you?" So notice how much he bends. In matters of truth, a believer should be as unmovable as an oak. when defending his own reputation, he ought to be like a willow. And this is exactly what this man was. He was firm as can be against the Midianites, but when it comes to these people over here that seem to have some strokes, and since it involves nothing more than my reputation, then I will say, you guys did a bigger and a better job than I did. And with that, notice verse 3, their anger toward him subsided when he said that. Then Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came to the Jordan, crossed over, and they are weary, and yet they are still pursuing. And that is a good part to break. We will pick up with 8:4, the cleanup operations on Wednesday, and finish out through the rest of the life of Gideon. And then we will find out that Gideon will give birth to a son called Abimelech, who's going to cause real trouble in Israel. Father, we're thankful tonight for your word that is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword. May we recognize the lesson that is taught here, that you do not win by 32,000, you do not win by 10,000, you win with 300 unarmed. And thus the battle is yours and the victory is yours, and you are honored and you are glorified. And we pray that as we continue to complete the life of Gideon, we will learn the lessons that are involved in it, in Christ's name.